Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to an encore edition of Soundcheck. So I thought Dance Dance Revolution was just a video game, but it turns out it's actually not far from the truth. This is Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, the cultural, indeed revolutionary history of ballet from the inside. And later, Harold O'Neill is a dancer and martial artist and a jazz pianist on the rise, and he'll join us to play live. But first, ballet is having a cultural moment, with Nutcracker season just behind us, and the film Black Swan, whose soundtrack you're hearing in the background, continuing to jeter its way across movie screens around the country. The art of ballet is alive and well in the public eye. But Jennifer Homans, who has written a very thorough cultural history of the form, has also stirred some controversy. She wonders whether ballet might be on its last legs. Joining me now to discuss her book, Apollo's Angels, is the writer and dancer Jennifer Homans. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So there's an interesting story behind the title, which I want to get to in just a little while. But is this really the first comprehensive history of ballet?
It really is. There are, you know, histories of moments in ballet. Studies of Diaghilev, studies of the Russian period, but there were a lot of blanks. So, you know, I was myself a dancer, and I kept on trying to read what was the history of this art form, and I found myself having to go all over the place to piece it together. So once I went to graduate school, studied history, became a historian, I sort of realized I could put all this together and try to create a seamless narrative story of the history.
And it's a 400-year history of ballet.
That's right. It begins in the Renaissance, in the Italian and French courts, but really takes its central, pivotal starting point from the court of Louis XIV.
So you go through the various iterations and evolutions of ballet over the course of 400 years and like 8,000 pages. And then at the end, everyone in the dance community is like buzzing about the final chapter, which almost seems like an elegy for ballet. Do you really think it's on its way out?
Look, the epilogue... Here I had spent, you know, over a decade studying 400 years of this art form, and what I learned from that is that the art form has great ebbs and flows. It collapses at certain points and falls away. In the past, it has always then been picked up somewhere else. You know, falls apart in France, is picked up in Russia, and revives and revitalizes itself. I think at the moment, if you put our present period, at the end of that long history, you'll see that we're really in one of the dips, and we don't know what's going to happen. You know, this book is a defense of the art. I'm, you know, no one would be happier to see it do well than I would.
And you do say, you know, maybe I'll be proved wrong, and someone will come along.
Yeah, but it doesn't do anybody any good to just say everything's fine when really it's not.
Mm-hmm. Although, you know, we've heard the same thing, the same predictions of the imminent demise of classical music, you know, and of course the histories of ballet and classical music very closely intertwined in recent years, the last 150 years at least. Jazz, you know, pronouncements of its impending death as well. You know,
ballet in its forms is very sturdy and very flexible. It there are dancers training at this moment as we speak, who are becoming, absolutely immersed and obsessed even with the classical purity of this art form. So in that sense, yes, it is it's sort of eternal in its way. But, you know, we shouldn't assume, is what I'm saying, that it can go on forever. We have to really cultivate it and think about it carefully.
Well, also, and what you just said, you know, that sense of classical purity is a very easy way to get yourself stuck in a box and to become a museum piece as opposed to a living a still evolving tradition.
It is easy. And, you know, classical ballet is torn always, or, you know, sort of drawn between these two poles, one of a classical tradition and of a very sort of old tradition that, you know, you are always harking back to. People perform the classic Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty all the time, but it also has to be new, now, here, every day. Something, and that's where the problem is. Mm. I mean, we still have a lot of classical, in some ways, classical ballet has never been healthier in the sense that, you know, it has a prominent place in opera houses. The major companies all have fantastic facilities and money to support them. But that doesn't mean that artistically, inside the art form, it's thriving.
Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? You can leave a comment on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. There is much to talk about with Jennifer Homan's book, Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet. But in the dance community, everyone's been talking about this epilogue. Is ballet, you know, at the end of a road? Is there the possibility of making a left or right turn onto another road? Leave us a comment on the Soundcheck page, WNYC.org. And Jennifer, you said that as a dancer yourself, you wanted to try and read up about this piece or that period of history, and that there were these huge gaps in the history of ballet. Ballet, unlike music, is not a written. I mean, there are no notated scores. I mean, there are nowadays to an extent.
No, right. You know, this is one of the great challenges of writing a history, which is that, you know, the tradition is oral. You know, there are some notation systems, but they're not widely used, and they've never been widely accepted. So that when a dancer, you know, goes into a studio to learn a ballet like Swan Lake, for example, you know, she's learning it from a dancer who did it before. She's not learning it from a piece of paper or from a libretto or a script. She's really trying to understand it by watching the movements, and it's a physical memory.
So when we go back to the earliest years, I mean, anything pre-video, you really are in the domain of legend, of mythology, all the things,
you know,
that have changed folk music over the centuries.
That's right. It's a very malleable form in that way, and one that's got a very, you know, the ballets of the 18th century, of the 17th century, we don't know what most of those ballets looked like. We can't reconstruct them. There are a few because there is a notation from the early 18th century that we do still know how to read, but it fell out of use very quickly. So that's just one little piece. It's a snapshot. The rest is very, very hazy. And then the ballets that we think of today as classics are from the late 19th century in Russia. Those were written down, you know, in longhand, in little notes, but mainly they have been passed along orally, and that's why we have them. Mm-hmm. Of course, today we have film, so that has transformed this picture. And, you know, it will be different for generations to come. Assuming ballet survives. But there, you know, there are problems with film, too, because film is not, you know, you're filming one performance, one moment, one time.
It's the same problem that jazz aficionados have with, well, that's Lester Young on that night in that club. That is not the definitive performance of that piece by, you know. All right, so let's take for an example 1681, the court of Louis XIV. We don't know what the dances exactly were like, but we know Louis danced, right?
That's right. We know from many sources that Louis was himself a marvelous dancer and very dedicated one, especially in his youth. He performed in his own spectacles. He took a great interest. He trained every morning. And so he was very much a patron and a dancer himself.
And in this early ballet by Lully called Le Triomphe de l'Amour by Jean-Baptiste Lully, his partner is Pierre Beauchamp in a female role. Because at this point, I guess women were not allowed to dance, right?
That's right. Women were not allowed to perform. It's a little confusing because women did dance, but they did not perform in the king's spectacles. And those roles were taken by men.
So imagine King Louis XIV of France and Pierre Beauchamp doing something to this music by Jean-Baptiste Lully. Jean-Baptiste Lully in La Triomphe de l'Amour, The Triumph of Love, Ballet Suite No. 2. This was written for and would have been danced by King Louis XIV of France and Pierre Beauchamp, who, Jennifer, was...
Who was his ballet master, who was his trainer,
teacher,
and himself an accomplished performer.
And as I mentioned before, in a female role, would balletophiles today have recognized Le Triomphe de l'Amour as a ballet?
I mean, I think, a lot of people have seen what we now think of as Baroque dances, which is what that would have looked like. And those dances are actually in some ways more accessible, surprisingly, than dances of the early 19th century, which came later, because there is, as I mentioned earlier, a notation that allows us to put those together in a more sort of accurate way.
And so it was more courtly dancing. There were a lot of leaps and
that's right. This
pirouettes.
Is very much a court dance. It derives from a social dance and from an etiquette.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you present yourself, how you bow, how you take a hand. These are not leaps. They're wearing shoes with small heels. And the women, of course, are in very heavy dresses when they do dance. And the men have, costumes that show their legs. And so they were the featured performers. They did the bravura beating and technical quick steps that people admired, and also the slow, elegant movements.
We're speaking with Jennifer Homans. Her book is called Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet. It's a 400-year history going back to the Renaissance, the courts of France and Italy. And at some point, it does change. Things do change. A lot of what you tell us about the history of ballet is a reaction to social and political and cultural changes in the countries themselves, in Western Europe especially. How much, if at all, does ballet provoke social or cultural change, especially at the point when women are allowed on stage?
Well, that moment when women really not just take the stage but become the central players in the art, that's a moment where ballet really becomes a focal point for political and social movements and change, because it's an aristocratic art form. And in the years around the French Revolution, of course, the aristocrats are targeted, and there's a great bitter hatred of everything aristocratic, including ballet. And so, what happens as ballet passes through the French Revolution is that it really, the male dancer, the king, is discredited and becomes, in France actually, a source of ridicule. And women fill the void. They come into a central role, and ballet becomes more about love, the imagination, dreams, a romantic landscape depicted on stage.
So it becomes less about the gods of Olympus and some Arcadian mythology of classical times.
That's right. The subjects change. The people doing it change in the sense of it becomes more about women than about men. And the aesthetic changes too. This is when you get the introduction of women on toe, mm-hmm. on doing point work.
And this all happens around a single woman.
Well, yes, it does. I mean, the woman who becomes most famous for it is Marie Taglioni. And you may have seen pictures of her sweetly posed in the ballet La Sylphide, which was her sort of signature ballet in the early 1830s, which she performed, by the way, across Europe. She was really an international star. So yes, Marie Taglioni was the person who sort of absorbed all of these changes and managed to take the noble etiquette and technique that had been so present in the aristocratic art form and sort of transform it into a feminine beauty.
So she really becomes kind of a lightning rod of social change, maybe even without knowing it, because, I mean, there would have been women in all of these countries seeing this pretty... Was she pretty?
Well, you know, that's actually a funny thing to ask, because, in fact, she wasn't.
But she became a sex symbol anyway.
She made herself beautiful by the way she moved. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and she became, you say, a sex symbol, but she also became a magnet for women. It's very interesting that women were very interested in her performance, and there was something about the way that she moved, the yearning, the sense of the ethereal, the sense of wanting more and of unrequited love that really drew women at the time.
Now, again, we don't know, we can't know exactly what her moves were. There's no notation. The music survives to much of, or at least some of what she danced to. And in 1845, she danced this pas de quatre with music by Cesare Pugni. Early 19th century, it was Marie Taglioni who revolutionized the world of ballet and turned it into something we might recognize as ballet even today. The story of the history of ballet is in the book Apollo's Angels. My guest is Jennifer Homans, and we'll speak more with her and get to some of the more controversial things happening in the ballet world today as we continue our conversation. And then later, pianist Harold O'Neill. He's a dancer and a martial artist who also happens to be a rising star at the jazz piano, and he'll play live at our piano on Soundcheck. Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we've been talking with the writer, historian, and former dancer, Jennifer Homans, about her recent cultural history of ballet called Apollo's Angels. In the background, Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. It is one of the most popular and enduring ballets, and Jennifer, you call it, quote, the most imperfect but powerful of all Russian ballets. Russian ballet being kind of a thing unto itself, I guess, right?
Well, the Russian ballet tradition developed out of the French tradition. It developed really out of the Russian admiration for everything French in the Russian court. But then, you know, in the course of especially the 19th century, ballet really developed into a distinctive Russian art. It became bigger, grander, scaled to the dimensions of St. Petersburg, you might say.
And if Marie Taglioni was a big figure in developing ballet in the early part of the century, in the later part of the century, you have to look at people like Tchaikovsky, right? The composer.
You absolutely have to look at Tchaikovsky, whose music was a radical change from the kinds of music that dancers were performing to before. You know, here you had a full orchestral sound with challenges that dancers resisted at first, didn't want to dance to that kind of music, too tough. And, you know, Petipa, the choreographer, Marius Petipa, who was French but had made his home in the Russian court, you know, I think he knew that he was being pushed and involved in a great experiment mm-hmm. when he worked with Tchaikovsky.
So the Nutcracker, Swan Lake, I mean, these have become cultural touchstones, you know, beyond the usual borders of ballet, to the point that we have films. I mean, wasn't Billy Elliot about a boy who wants to dance in Swan Lake?
And that's right.
And Black Swan now in the theaters. Have you seen Black Swan?
I have indeed seen Black Swan.
What did you think?
You know, Black Swan has a brilliant central premise, an insight into ballet, which is that it is an art of transformation. You know, the idea that this dancer can become something else and that the life of her imagination and the life of her life, as it were, are sort of fused and indistinguishable. However, it should be said that Black Swan is not an accurate portrayal of the dance world. It's a horror film. I mean, that's what Aronofsky says. It's a horror film, and it is a horrific. And, you know, it's set in the dance world, and it takes everything in dance and makes it into something pretty awful. You know, devotion becomes obsession. Sacrifice becomes martyrdom. Pain becomes self-mutilation. So it's a really ugly portrait of... You don't have any poetry in this world. There's no sense of why dancers would ever want to do that. So I think there's a lot missing. It's not really a dance film in that way. It's a different genre.
Well, and it certainly is a kind of a portrait of obsession, it seems.
It's a portrait of the undoing of a young woman's mind. And, you know, one of the touch points that the film has made a lot of people think about is The Red Shoes, the 1948 Powell and Pressburger film about dance. But you know, the differences are actually quite striking because that film starred Moira Shearer, who was herself a spectacularly good dancer, and there are long dance sequences in that film. Black Swan does not have a lot of dancing in it.
Although Natalie Portman and you know, some of the other actresses have talked about what they had to go through just to be able to pull off these roles in a at least semi-convincing fashion. Here's actually a quick clip from the movie The Black Swan.
In 4 years, every time you dance, I see you obsessed getting each and every move perfectly right, but I never see you lose yourself. Ever. All that discipline for what?
Just want to be perfect.
You what?
Want to be perfect.
Perfection is not just about control. It's also about letting go. Surprise yourself so you can surprise the audience. Transcendence. And very few have it in them.
I think I do have it in.
From the movie Black Swan, which really does give us the dark side of the world of ballet, the more... a fuller picture, let's say, is in Jennifer Homan's book called Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet. And, you know, what Natalie Portman had to go through, what any dancer has to go through in terms of the body, shaping the instrument, the tool that you use to dance, that goes to the title of your book, doesn't it? Apollo's Angels. Tell us what that means.
It does indeed. I mean, the Apollonian, the image of the body as something that can be elevated and perfected and made into something more than it is in its everyday life is something that stands at the heart of the tradition. And although, you know, there was no ballet back in ancient Greece, dancers since the beginning of the art have looked to antiquity as a source of inspiration. And not just you know, not just some idea of measure and perfection, but also an idea of the way in which we can train our bodies so that we move one step up, and this is a very Renaissance idea, on the great chain of being away from the bestial sides of our existence and towards the angels. And that's where the angels comes into the title. So it's really an art of aspiration and high ideals.
So then let me ask you what you make of another controversy, another hornet's nest that has been stirred up in the dance world. Alistair McCauley in the New York Times, you know, pointing out in a review that a certain dancer looked like she had had perhaps one sugar plum too many. And then writing an entire other column after this firestorm of controversy breaks out to explain, in essence, what you just said, that there's some kind of Apollonian ideal here that dancers need to be striving for. What's your take on that?
I don't think that dancers would shy away from the idea, and certainly the dancer in question did not, you know, that the body is the instrument. And, you know, it's certainly very important that the instrument be in good working order and be beautiful. that said, I mean, I think that the controversy has in some ways obscured a more central point, or we've lost sight of something in it, which is that it's not really perfection. And this goes back to Black Swan, too. It's not perfection that makes a great dancer. It's some sense of inner illumination. It's a drama unfolding in the body. And that can happen in all kinds of bodies. The aesthetic that we've today given to ballet is one that is slender and sort of smooth in that way. But
would we have recognized Marie Taglioni as a ballet dancer?
Marie Taglioni looked very different from the dancers today. You know, so those things do change and evolve. What doesn't change is the greatness of a dancer as defined by a drama or an illumination through the body that really is almost God-given. I mean, it's something that just some people get on stage and they have that, you know. And it's a way that the body responds to music and rhythm and light.
And music.
It's hard to define. And music, absolutely music.
Now, one of the high water marks of ballet, certainly in this country, was Georges Balanchine. You studied with Balanchine, right?
I studied at Balanchine's school. And so, you know, I was trained very much by the Russians that came to this country in the wake of the First World War and the Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and built a sort of little Russia in the middle of Manhattan. It was quite an experience to work with them. You know, many of my teachers there had been born in 19th century Russia, and here I was, a kid from Chicago, you know, studying with these great dancers. It was quite remarkable to me.
And talk about an oral tradition, you know, passing it down from teacher to student. That's basically what you
That's
got
it.
There.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, Balanchine struck up a relationship with Stravinsky, which proved to be hugely profitable for both, I mean, productive in terms of both musical scores and dances.
Absolutely. The collaboration between Balanchine and Stravinsky was seminal for ballet. I mean, you know, beginning with Apollo in the late 20s and straight through the Stravinsky Festival, which occurred just after Stravinsky's death, in which Balanchine produced many great, great dances.
So, you know, that was, you know, if there was a little lull before Balanchine, it was Balanchine and Stravinsky, that axis seems to have reawakened ballet. Now, to come back to where we were at the beginning, would it take something like that now, do you think, to revitalize the art form? Some hot young composer and choreographer getting together and doing some kind of Balanchine Stravinsky thing?
I mean, I don't know what it will take. You know, I think, you know, that's something that artists really have to answer. And, I mean, that has been tried. There are new collaborations happening between young choreographers and musicians who are working today. So, you know, people are working. But so far, we don't have anything like the Balanchine Stravinsky or the Petipa Tchaikovsky.
Mm. Or if we do, we just haven't recognized it yet. I mean, there is always that question, too.
I think we would know it.
Okay. In the background is some of Stravinsky's Agon, one of the successful scores that he wrote for Balanchine. And you can find the full history of Balanchine and Stravinsky as just one chapter in the even bigger history of ballet in the book Apollo's Angels. Jennifer Homans, thank you so much for being with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, jazz pianist Harold O'Neill joins us live in the studio to play music from his new album, Whirling Mantis. And there's a story behind that title as well. That's coming up next. You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Soundcheck.